Major Vizard, Reel 8. Now, we were discussing this, I would imagine, late May, when you took the prisoners of war through to Casablanca.
Yes.
You had a couple more points to make.
Only that it was a very testing time for the prisoners. I mean, it was bad enough for the escort, but for them, I think it was worse, because I did reserve one carriage on the 30 or 35 or 40 carriage truck, 40 truck train. I did reserve one as a sort of headquarters truck. And the members of the escort party could come down there, and they could in fact put their palliasse down and they could sleep there. But the prisoners, it was very trying, and I was very impressed by their discipline. These were very largely men from the Africa Corps, and they had their shorts, I noticed, had been khaki, but they had been scrubbed until they were practically rubbed. And every time they got a chance, every time the train stopped anywhere near a river, where, for example, there would be a mobile bath unit, they would go off and they would march. Their NCOs would form them up and they'd march down to the bath unit in a very orderly style, and they'd sing on the way, which is much more common with German troops than with British, I think. They would sing a song on the way. And one of our chaps would go along with rifle slung, because they were no danger. They weren't going anywhere. Their war was over. They'd had a good war. After all, the fought in the Africa Corps was pretty good. Fine unit. And but for the grace of God, they would have won, but not wanted. Anyway, they got to Barclay, and they mostly the streams. They get in there, and they were always reluctant to come out. Very clean people, and always they took off their kit, and they had brushes. They scrubbed it with stones, and their shirts and their shorts, and. They used to keep their boots as best they could clean. The RSM that they had with them, the Obo group and Führer, was astonishing. How he kept, I don't know. He had a crease in his trousers. On a train for 3 weeks, going from Tunis to Casablanca, he had a crease in his trousers. I'd never know how he did it. But he was a very smart fellow indeed, very smart. And he would report first thing in the morning, and he would listen to the orders for the day, and but unfortunately he had no French either, and my French was not good. I could converse with him quite easily. I think his English was a bit better than my German, but we got on very well. I liked him, a good man. I was glad to have him as a warrant officer. Excellent chap. Came from Lübeck. Yeah. Anyway, the prisoners eventually arrived, and they were discharged into these pens. I felt sorry for them. They didn't deserve that, really, but they were, I suppose they'd be fairly comfortable. And they were hutted camp inside a great huge tall wire with sort of towers at the corners, you know, searchlights and all that kind of thing. And I got back on the train, and it took another 3 weeks to get back. And so it was well into June, I should think. It'd be into June. And at that time, the town, I think, was still in the suburbs of Tunis. But I came back, I remember, and they were all packing. And I'd been travelling for 6 weeks, five anyway. And I thought, my God, what are they all packing for? And they said, we're going down to...
Bleda?
No. Place between Fort de Lo and... It must be in the book. It's a French.
It says Bleda here.
Bleda. That's right, and it was a Bleda too. Yes, Bleda. So, famous French army, French foreign. Foreign Legion centre, leader, west of Algiers. And we had a hutted, we had a tented camp. And I got into trouble because one of my travellers had picked up a bell tent. And being young and foolish, I insisted on having a bell tent. So mine was the only bell tent, and everybody else had eight-man tents, you see. Remember the brigadier coming round, and the colonel, and he said to the colonel, "What's that monstrosity doing here?" And the colonel said, "Oh, that's me." And they let me away with it. He could stand up in it, but he couldn't really stand up in the eight-man. So we were there, and we did some really hard training. We used to march up the mountain road to a place called Shrea, C-H-R-E-A, which was a famous French ski resort. We weren't really skiing then, it was May, but, and also June. And we used to march up there, and it would be about, I suppose the road was about 6 miles, 7 miles up to the top. And we'd do that every day. And then we'd come down rough, clambering down the mountainside, because we'd been warned already that we were going to our next move. We didn't know where it was, but it would require mountain. So we used to go up to the top of Shrea and come down every day. We marched up the road 6 miles and came down about 1 mile perpendicular, and, you know, scrambling down as best you can, ended up with a lot of cuts and bruises and grazes at the bottom. Straight down to the medical post, get plastered up, then go do the same thing the next day. And we did a lot of square mashing too. First thing in the morning, about 5:30, 5:45, as soon as it was light, out on the parade ground, on a foot drill, and Sergeant Major May was very good indeed at foot drills, and he drilled that A company magnificently. In fact, the colonel said that they were certainly the best drilled company in the battalion. And the whole battalion was doing these morning drills. There were also a lot of running, cross-country running, and that sort of thing went on. There was rugger matches, not rugger, football matches. I'm a rugger enthusiast. Football for me is a poor game, but there was football matches, and there was some cricket even. I was swimming, because we weren't far from the coast. And it was a pretty hard time, but there were recreations, there were concerts, and I remember going to it. I think there was even ENSA.
What were these concerts like? As entertainment?
Well, I think after you'd been to one or two, you didn't bother anymore. They really went, I mean, sometimes you've got a good fella. I remember meeting Jimmy James. Comedian, and he was in ENSA, and he's quite good, he's a good comic, but there weren't very many, and well, it was something to do, and you always went along, but after you've been to two or three, I think then you didn't bother. We had a mess. I think it was the first time we'd ever had an officers and sergeants mess. I think that was the first time. It was a very crude affair, but we had it.
What was the mess like? I mean, you know, mess life, like.
Well,
because at that time, according to the list, it was you at A, Johnson at B, Joby at C, Duffy at D, and then Reynolds was HQ company.
Yeah, Tom Reynolds was HQ company.
And Balance as support company, S company.
Yes, George Balance. Now, George Balance is a character that's well worth mentioning. He was the son of Lady Balance, whom I went to see after the war, as he was killed in Italy. He was very tall. He was wearing blue, Cambridge. And he was a tremendous character. He was the sort of fellow, almost impossible not to be able to get on with. He was a giant of a man. And I remember coming to order groups with George Balance, and a hearty greeting you always got from him, no matter how wet and miserable we were, because for the first part of Algeria, Tunisia, it rained and rained and rained. But George was always cheerful. He spent all night long dragging boxes of rations around and ammunition and so forth, because he was headquarters company, and QM was there, RSM was there, ammunition and food. But George would always greet you with a broad smile and slap you on the back and so forth and make you feel better. Great man, George Balance. And he was a support company.
And what about...
Interesting, we just got support company. And the colonel sent for me one day and he said, I've got 12 Vickers medium machine guns arriving. He said, I don't know anything about them at all. He said, I hear that you... I said, yes, I was Middlesex trained. Should never be in the Durhams, I should be in the Middlesex. So he said, well, will you? I said, yes, leave it to me. So I took a small party, a sergeant, a lance corporal, and four, I think. And they were all in wooden cases, and we opened all the cases, and they were all in mineral jelly.
What's that? That's to protect them?
To protect it, yes, mineral jelly. Oh, being smothered in mineral jelly, straight from the manufacturers. Because. Anyway, I got these Cook's mobile solid fuel wood or coal boilers that they produce soup in. So, and I heated up these things, and I dropped the gun and its barrel and its tripod and everything else into these and cooked all the mineral jelly up. Eventually we got them clean. It took 10 days, I think, it took to do the job. Got them all clean thoroughly. Then they had to be assembled. Only I could do that. Then you had to get the right weight on the fusee spring. And you had to get the nuts adjusted and pulled just so that you could, the taps came down 15 seconds per tap. And then we fired them out to sea. And we had ammunition for them. And we fired all of them. Out to sea. I did a bit of firing in the quarry in order to see whether they were true or not. And they seemed fairly good. So then the support company took them over because I had to train support gunners. Wasn't very easy. Didn't have a lot of time, but I did it actually at Leda. I had a squad of machine gunners and I trained them. That was one thing I was really fit to do, much more than an infantry officer.
So they'd sent these machine guns up with, I mean, did they know you were there to do all this, or?
No.
So it's just a matter of luck.
Well, I think if the colonel had complained to brigade, no doubt brigade would have got onto the division and somebody would have been found. Because after all, Manchester Regiment was in First Army somewhere or other, and they would have provided machine guns. But they kept them as a machine gun battalion. And there weren't any Middlesex in North Africa that I'm aware of at all. There were some Chesters, I think, and Chesters were machine gun battalions. No, they would have found them, but it was very handy because I could do it, you see. And as I say, it took 10 days, and then I sent them off to support companies. Support companies didn't use them because they wanted to fire them. And then we got to Bleda. I had these training squads, and we did all fall out one. You know, fall out one reminded me of Hive. And they looked at me and thought, well, we're not going to do this in battle, are we, fall out one? I said, no, it's just to get you used to it. The idea is that you take the tripod, I'll take the gun. You know, I'll be in Scotland before you. Yes. So this training period, it was quite interesting because we were told to go to certain areas which had a configuration on the land similar to that which we were going to confront. And we went into the Atlas Hills to the Palestra Gorge, which is very steep indeed, and rocky and chalky, and Palestra Gorge, and we did our activities there, mountain attack. And running in there, it was pretty clear to us, I think, that we were going to be on an assault landing, but it was a close kept secret, locations and so on.
Did you actually practice landing?
Yeah.
You know, from boats?
Only later. It would be in August, I should think. by which time we'd come back to Bizerta.
Right.
Because from Breda we went straight to Bizerta.
So
Breda, we left, I'm not sure when we left Breda, I think it must have been July.
So the specialist weapons were all being pulled back to the support company, yes. So rifle companies were very much rifle companies.
Yes, rifle had Brens, and they had 2-inch mortars, Tommy guns. So,
yeah. And the support company, would they have carriers at this?
They had a platoon of carriers and a platoon of 3-inch mortars, and this machine gun, which actually carried on the carriers, the machine guns, because mounted on the carriers.
Were they detachable?
Yeah, they were detachable, but they were bolted. You could fire from the carrier.
So the idea was to use them from the carrier. Were the carriers much good in when you went in the mountains?
They were no good in, well, they were all right in sand, but the problem was that they didn't last very long. Everything was filled with sand. And it was really awful. You couldn't keep anything clean. I really don't know how the people kept the trucks running. You had to strip everything down. I mean, you've got sand in the carburetor. And people were taking down carburetors forever, washing them out and blowing them through. It was very difficult terrain to work in. But the carriers were all right up to a point. If you got a soupçon of solid ground, you could move. But the moment you got into any kind of deep sand, then the carrier would bury it, would simply bury itself up to its axles. No good.
I was wanting to ask a bit more about the mess life. I mean, it was very informal, you said, but what sort of mess life did you have as a group of officers?
We had a mess sergeant, and he had a staff who were waiters, and they had never been waiters before, and they didn't do it very well at first, anyway. We had canvas chairs. We had a bar of sorts. There wasn't a lot to be had, but plenty of vino from the Algerian vineyards. There was plenty of Algerian wine to drink.
Was it a hard drinking mess? Or
No, the work was too hard for that. Anyway, very few of these fellows were drinking men. I mean, they were mostly still very young, you see. Officers were only 23, 24. They hadn't got into any. I mean, they'd come through their, I suppose they'd come through their drinking spells as young men. Smell of the barmaid's apron at 17 and that sort of thing. But they, by the time they got there, they were very happy to sit down. What they wanted was some beer. There was some beer, but it was Algerian beer. Well, we used to drink it in preference to the wine, but not a lot.
And what about the food? I mean, this is out of the line, of course. I mean, would you have a mess fund?
There was a mess fund, and we had a mess bill to pay, and there was a contribution towards food purchased on the civilian market, yes. You could get chickens and eggs and so forth, and there was some veal to be had, a bit of pork. But there wasn't, of course, any equipment. The battalion never really... I mean, there was a battalion mess in Westwood Camp in the 16th, and had a mess of sorts. We had a few tablecloths, obviously hadn't any silver, nothing like that. And the cutlery, everybody provided their own. You had your own knife, fork, and spoon, lather, comb, and lather brush, and all that. No, it was a very makeshift affair. We had a very popular steward, barman, called Simpson, J.K. Simpson, who became immortalized for having, later in the story, produced a punch known as Redskin 88, which floored the hardest people. But J.K. Simpson, he was very popular. But it was all right. We used to go there in the evening when it was cooler, although most people preferred to find their own forms of entertainment. You could go into... Maison Carrie, you go into Fort Low, you go up to the beach. I became very fond of a little place called Chenoa Plage. Chenoa, C-H-E-N-O-A. canal was a French resort, and it was not no great distance. And I used to spend, certainly any weekend spare time, I used to spend there. And it was quite hilly, but it had a beach, obviously, the plage. And this tannery there, you could go in, four or five or six of them would go in, order an omelette for 12 eggs, and that sort of thing, and had red wine and French bread, and then you'd swim and lie on the beach, and that was, to me, much more interesting. The mess didn't worry us too much. And we used to go there because there was a dining-in night, and the colonel had to instruct people how to behave in the mess anyway, because most of them had never really been in a properly established army mess, which was in wartime.
What sort of rules did the colonel want to see enforced? Because there's a lot of mess. There's different levels of mess.
Yes, well, the colonel was very tolerant, frankly, old Johnny Preston. But he liked, when you went in the place, he liked to single out the senior man and go up and say, good evening, sir, or good afternoon, sir, or whatever it might have been. So that you sort of registered your presence. He liked bush shirt and long. He didn't like people in shorts and the mess, and obviously no belts. He insisted on politeness to mess staff, and he's also the man who insisted on us calling warrant officers Mr. Not only the RSM, normally you'll find the RSM is called Mr. But he said, no, he said, you call the Hussar Majors, Mr. He said, do a power of good for their morale. So we did this. When we came in contact with other troops, and they saw us calling them Mr. This and Mr. They said, what the hell are you doing then? Not commissioned. No, no, I. I remember they were very pleased, Pearly Gates. I said, morning, Mr. Gates. Morning, sir. I think the colonel was right, it did something for them.
What about in the mess, would ranks not count, presumably, after you'd done this registering?
If two of you were making towards a chair, one was a major and the other was a subaltern, or something. But it was very much share and share alike, yes, there wasn't much to share anywhere.
So would a second lieutenant call you V in the mess? Not outside, presumably?
No, the colonel was fairly strict on this. He liked his troops to salute their officers. He liked his officers to salute the adjutant the best time of the day. And he was a disciplinarian. He's a regular officer. And he knew what was right, what was wrong. He was a strict disciplinarian. And, of course, discipline meant a folding stool under a tree. I mean, that was company office. And the fenders, I mean, I had a folding stool as part of my camp equipment. I still had it. It's in my shed out there. After all these years, it's still in one piece and I can still sit on it. It's one of those canvas things, canvas back, canvas seat, and bamboo. And it, I used to sit on this under a olive tree and administer justice. And it was nearly always drunk and disorderly or something of that kind. Very little serious crime. Occasionally, an NCO would bring somebody up for not for refusing to obey an order, but for bad conduct or grubbiness and that kind of thing. You give it 3 days or something. Remember, what did it mean in 3 days? And you were sitting on a hillside? Nothing. 3 days fatigues meant something, I suppose, of course. But I used to get later on in Tunis, and when I was in Hammond Lip for a short time, my chaps used to come back and they were the worst for wear, and the provos used to throw them into a truck and bring them back to the guard room. Next day they used to come up in front of me, and I nearly always found that the fellows who were the biggest offenders were the best soldiers. Ones with a long conduct sheet were the best. nice fellows when you were in action. They were the ones that were still there and hadn't done your shallow treatment. Yes. There's quite a lot of that did go on.
I'll come back to that. You're referring to shell hole dropping, which is people disappearing in action.
Yes. Some of them were still there, but outside. But the fellows that were there, and clearly inside, were the fellows who came back from the town having had too much to drink.
Well, you say 3 days. That's 3 days confined to barracks. There'd be no barracks.
Yeah. 3 days fatigued. Normally that meant some unpleasant task, like weapon cleaning or receptacles for cleaning. Or in one case, I remember a fellow was told off to look after the mules. And that meant 3 days running down mules.
And would there ever be anything that went higher up the chain?
Yes. Any kind of serious crime would be remanded for CO, certainly, yes.
Was there much of that?
No. No, there was more of some in Italy, but there wasn't much in Africa. But the colonel was quite strict, and he didn't mince his words with people, and if he thought that they'd stepped over the line or done something stupid and so forth, or if they'd been caught nodding on sentry duty, that was the worst one, I think.
And he was strict with you as well?
Yes. Well, he was a very friendly fellow, but he was quite strict, yes. I mean, he was a man whose eyes were all round the place. He could see everything. And he said to me one day, when we were, I think this would be when we were up around the Gibraltar Plain, and he said to me, he said, I've just come along the ridge. He said, there's a sergeant down there of yours hasn't shaved this morning. I said, well, that's surprising. There was no good water. I mean, when we were up at the Gubelup, we were shaving in our own water. After you'd had your tea, you'd pee, and then you'd get your brush out. And he said, well, you're very strict about this sort of thing. Shaving, brief and shaving. Everybody had to shave. It didn't matter. You might be running up a beach under shell fire. You still had to be shaved. Discipline. He believed in discipline. He said, it holds people together. When things get rough, it's the ones who are disciplined who come through. I think it's true. I therefore, as a civilian, had little time for square bashing, but I realised later on that square bashing is important. Initially, it gets the body to be cohesive, gives them some pride in themselves. If they can march smartly, if they can do complicated manoeuvres in marching, counter-marching, which is very difficult, if they can do that, and they do it on parade, and people admire them, and they feel proud of themselves, and get morale building. But we got summoned. We moved up to...
Hang on, there's only a couple of... Would he ever dress you down?
Theo?
Yeah.
I didn't get a dressing down until I returned to the battalion from AWOL.
But did he ever discipline any of your other officers, your junior officers? I mean, would he tell them off? And if so, would he do it in private? Or?
I think he was dissatisfied with some people's conduct, and I think he used to call them to his tent. I think he did it privately. I never saw him at any time reprimand any rank in public. He left that to the warrant officers. Warrant officers would do a lot of reprimanding in public. You great big dozy man, and so on, and this sort of thing. But not the CO. No, I never saw him do that. I never had occasion to be reprimanded. And we were on detachment a lot. I mean, I saw as much of the Foresters Colonel and the Leicesters Colonel and the York and Lancs Colonel, Aubrey Miller.
And how did they compare with Preston?
I reckon Preston was the match of any of them and the better than most. A jolly good colonel.
Who was the Foresters Colonel at the time, Jim?
Buchanan, I think. I think it was Colonel Buchanan. He certainly was the one in the White House who came out that night with us.
What do you think of him?
Because I remember saying to him, after you, sir. And he said, no, after you. He said, you know the way here. Yes, Buchanan.